Well, Randy's already introduced with the Advent wreath this issue that we have with the real meaning of Christmas. We hear that quite often on television, and it's the theme of films and movies. What is the real meaning of Christmas? And that usually they come to some conclusion that it's some soft, wonderful, warm feeling in your heart or being kind to others. And again, those are all very, very fine and good things. But the real meaning of Christmas, after all, must be about Christ. It is, after all, Christmas, right? So what we're going to see today is a story about the actual, an analogy about the real meaning of Christmas. God gave his son to provide peace for a sinful, lost humanity to purchase peace with himself. God paid the price of sin, which was death. He paid it by giving his own son, the life of his son, that he might purchase peace. That's what Christmas is about. And because of the nature of the Trinity, something completely unique, God gave himself when he gave his son. Sometimes it's a little bit easier for us to think that, oh, I could give of myself, just don't ask me to give my kids. I really love my kids. Well, how many times do we wish that we could take a pain that has fallen upon our children? It would be easier if we could do that. These are things that God has put within us that we might understand what it felt like for him to give his son, to give all that he could give, to win our peace. A redemptive analogy is what we're going to see. It is the true story of Christmas in a true story that you'll see up here. It's called Peace Child. God puts, I believe, redemptive analogies in all cultures around the world that we might be able to understand what he has in his heart, the love that he has for us. In 1962, I think that's like 52 years ago, maybe some of you were born in 1962. Steve, you were not. Don and Carol Richardson left their home in the plains of Saskatchewan, Canada, to go to Irian Jaya, what was then called Irian Jaya, Dutch New Guinea. Political changes have now renamed that place to Papua, and it belongs to Indonesia. This is an island north of Australia, the most primitive place, forgotten place on the face of the earth, particularly in 1962. What the film does not show is not only did they go as a young couple, but they brought their seven-month-old baby in their arms with them. You'll not see that, but you'll be amazed to think of that as you see the opening scenes of this film. In 1972, just 10 years later, they went to the people that they had found there, a tribe called the Sawi people, and they asked them if they could tell the rest of the world the story of what God had done for their tribe of people. And the Sawi people said, yes, you may tell the world. We will permit that. And so they came and they made a film. The actors in the film are, it's a documentary, there's no soundtrack, there's no music, nothing that pulls on the heartstrings. It is a missionary documentary. The actors are Don and Carol Richardson, playing Don and Carol Richardson, and the Sawi people playing the Sawi people. These are people who had never seen a movie camera in their life before it pulled up on their shore. You'll be amazed to see how well they do. In my opinion, this is the best missionary documentary film ever made, and I'm excited that we have a chance to be able to see it. In 1972, when it came out, it was very controversial, and there were many churches who would not show it in their church services. There are churches today who will not show this film in their services because it is realistic. It is very realistic. And it's my pleasure to introduce the meaning of Christmas through the eyes of the Sawi people, Peace Child.
Irian Jaya. It was still called Netherlands, New Guinea in the early 1960s when I traveled with my wife into the jungle swamps where a tribe called the Sawi had their villages. Though I had no way of knowing it then, we had come down the Kunkel River with the same trust that a tribesman named Mavo had only a year before. I realize now what danger we were in. From a people who held treachery as their highest virtue. Mavo was a Sawi from the upstream village of Hainam, who found himself dangerously close to Kamur territory. Both were Sawi villages, Kamur and Hainam, that had been feuding for centuries.
It's happening, Lisa. Yo, it's happening, quick.
I wonder if they'd spotted us, the headhunters of Kamur, as they had Mavo. Recklessly, perhaps, Mavo took time to rest on the riverbank and drink. The Kamur warriors assured Mavo that they meant no harm. Rather, they wished to bestow upon him an honor. Would he consent to be a go-between? A go-between his village of Hainam and their own village, Kamur. Mavo demanded proof of sincerity. Proof against treachery. The Kamur spokesman offered Mavo a part of his own body as proof.
Dero. Yeah, Dero.
Putting suspicion out of mind, Mavo broke his journey and returned to Hainam with the news. Being chosen as a go-between raised his prestige considerably in his own village. It was Mavo's pride more than good sense that carried him on his first visit to Kamur. He was received as a friendly ambassador, escorted into the manhouse. And any lingering fear of treachery was forgotten. Mavo couldn't wait to get home, where he dazzled his village with the account of his reception. Afterwards, he made many trips to Kamur over several months. Always, he was received with warm friendship. This time, they honored him with a fine feast, with all the warriors of Kamur attending. Of wild pig, of grubs.
Yo.
We have fattened you with friendship for the slaughter. Mavo's head would be cut from his body, the brains eaten ritualistically. The jawbone would be made into a neck ornament to honor a woman. His flesh would be cooked and eaten by the village. A celebration of treachery. Of treachery played out with the subtlety and refinement of a game of chess. For the Sawi, treachery was the highest virtue. I was to learn of the slaughter of Mabo and come to feel its effects much later. The Sawi were virtually untouched then, their language unknown. I had come to Kumur 2 weeks before with another missionary and with sign language. Tried to make clear that I was coming back with my wife to live among them. For Carol and me, it was the end of a long journey. Before we met, Carol and I, each of us had made a commitment. We'd prepared ourselves at the same school in Canada, Prairie Bible Institute.
For instance, take Netherlands, New Guinea, where there are many men still living in the Stone Age. You may be the one called upon to make the first advance into the midst of entire tribes that have never known any kind of government control, where the people are a law unto themselves. You must reach them for Christ through languages never before learned by an outsider. There won't be any dictionaries to help you. You will have to produce your own. You will be encountering customs and beliefs that will be baffling to you.
We were in Sawi territory now, approaching the village of Kamur.
I told you we'd return. I've brought my wife with me. We're here to build a home. We're going to learn your language and your customs. We're going to bring you good news.
Once the villagers got over their shyness, they received us warmly. When word got out that a strange man and wife, who couldn't speak their tongue, were living among them, saw we tribesmen in full regalia arrive from up and down the river to welcome us. At last, Komur settled down to the routines of daily living, which among the Sawi had changed little in 1,000 years. We were heartened by the love that Sawi parents gave to their children, how they treasured them. But at that time, over half the Sawi babies born died before reaching childhood. For everyone, death was at every turn. Funerals were frequent. Death from sickness, from wild beasts. Death brought about by the endless warfare between Sawi villages. They'd wail, "O message of immortality, promised by our ancestors, where are you?" But we'd brought something that could help. Medicine. The mothers began coming to Carol, who trained as a registered nurse.
But I wanted it.
Okay, there it goes. Goodbye. Peace out.
It didn't take long for the men to realize that the steel axes I brought were superior to the stone axes they were used to. So I traded tools for their help in building a house for Carol and me. They learned fast. With Isai, one of their leaders, acting as a kind of tutor, we set ourselves to learn the Sawi language.
Banana, banana.
Horob,
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 horob, horob, horob, horob. Eat banana.
Koropadon.
Koropadon. Koropadon.
Koropadon.
Koropadon.
Koropadon.
Have a, have a.
What do?
What
do?
What do? What do?
What do?
What do?
What do Asiran?
What do Asiran? What do Asiran?
What do Asiran?
What do Asiran?
What do Asiran?
Town name.
Town name.
Town name.
Town name.
Town name. Sin gike favinai saden. Jesus timindigav sinav.
At last I could speak Sawi well enough to tell them the story of God giving his son to save us. They listened politely, but I got a deeper insight when I told them about Jesus' betrayal by Judas. To a people to whom treachery is the highest ideal, Judas emerges as a hero. With all our trying, no one would listen. There must be some way, I told myself, some tribal custom through which we could reach them with the message we'd come to bring. There was. Though we weren't prepared for the way it came upon us.
Ooh-ah, ooh-ah, ooh-ah.
women the first to give the alarm. The warriors of the village of Hainan had come to challenge Kamur to battle. Blood between them, and old wrongs to settle, such as the killing of Mapo. Isai accepted the challenge for Kamur, with boasting and with threats. Battles went on over weeks that became months. We tended the wounded and prayed. Carol and I had prepared for our calling. We had always depended on what we'd learned. Now, we were reduced to absolute dependence on God. Oh God, it was you who led us to these warring people. How can we persuade them to make peace when they honor treachery above everything else? Finally, I gave Isai an ultimatum. Either Kamur and Hainam stop the war, or we'd move to another Sawi village. They wanted us to stay. Because they wanted our steel axes and our medicines, Isai persuaded them to make peace. I wondered by what means they could show that they really meant peace, that their peace offer wasn't another ruse to fatten their enemies with friendship for a greater slaughter. Hainam on one side, Kamur on the other, the warriors prepared for a solemn ceremony. Painfully, Isai took his own infant son, his only child, from his wife. The mother wailed for the loss. Our hearts went out to her. After each of the Kamur warriors had touched him, Isai offered his son to the war chief of Hainam, who accepted him as the Taro, the peace child. As long as the child lived, the peace would be kept and all the wrongs of the past would be as though they had never been. The child was given to the care of a Hainam woman, who would rear him as her own. Then the warriors gathered at the manhouse and bound the two war chiefs with a bow, symbolizing the oppression of war. With the cutting of the bowstring, the peace was sealed. I've been baffled by it at first, until God gave me the grace to see that this was his means of making clear to the Sawi the good news that Carol and I had come to bring. In the same way, God saw that peace could not be unless he gave his son. With the Sawi peace child, the peace lasts only as long as the child lives. But God has sent the once and for all peace child, the Christ Torah, and he will never die. We couldn't have imagined the impact of these words on Isai. Because he'd given his own son, he grasped them fully, became our first Christian, and began telling others what was in his heart. In time, there were enough Sawi Christians to begin the construction of a church, a structure of a height and circumference they'd never seen before, yet using the same materials they used to build their houses. Carol's clinic and her reading classes grew and grew, while I took on a translation of the New Testament into the Sawi language. The missionary planes began flying in frequently, bringing help and materials to the growing church. The church was completed. Now Sawi tribesmen from villages that had once feuded endlessly with each other gather under its dome for fellowship. Isai became just one of the lay preachers in the congregation. Here, the Lord's Supper is celebrated with a roll of cooked sago, the staple of the Sawi people. And because the Sawi are without native drinking vessels, a tin can is our communion cup. As missionaries, we are dedicated to preserving all that is good in the art and culture and customs of the Sawi people. But encroachment from the outside is inevitable. Carol and I thank God that the gospel of Christ got here first.
Just a couple words in conclusion. God showed his love for a group of people who were completely forgotten and even unknown by the rest of the world. And he loved, it's an analogy of how he has shown his love for the whole world, which is lost, and for you and for me who have been lost. Little bit of a reminder of history. From 1960 to 1980, this is an amazing thing that happened there in Papua, what is now called Papua. From about 1960 to 1980, 90% of the native population of this island became believers, became Christians. This is an island that's 1,500 miles long and about 500 miles wide. A turning to Christ like that has been unprecedented since Patrick visited Ireland in the 7th century. A number of missionaries went and shared the gospel with people who were before that time unknown. Two of them at the same time that the Richardsons were there, actually a few years before, were my cousins, Dennis and Nancy Cochran, who worked in a village on the other side of the island, exactly like you've seen here. In 1990, about that time, there was a big political change, and the western end of New Guinea, that huge island north of Australia there, became a property of Indonesia. Indonesia is the largest Muslim population. How to say that properly? The largest population of Muslims of any country in the world. They treated Irian Jaya as a homesteading opportunity, and they treated the people there much in the same way as our European ancestors treated Native Americans, as if they weren't really people and their land wasn't theirs. They began a transmigration of people, a colonization from Indonesia into Papua in order to Islamize, bring the Islamic faith settled into the island. However, Jesus Christ had already arrived. And there were strong churches of believers there. And these people became missionaries to the colonizers and welcomed them, and to this day are reaching out to witness and to bring Jesus Christ into the lives of Muslim people who are being brought to them to do just the opposite. You see, God loves the Muslim people just as much as he loved these lost people in Irian Jaya. And he had it planned way before this ever happened. Quite an amazing thing. So God loves lost people enough to send his children to save them. And that's what he did here, and that's what he continues to do. And we heard a verse quoted this morning by Ed as he read it from John. It's a challenge to us. It's something that we need to be reminded of, and maybe something that we don't talk about quite enough or mention enough around here. And that is this challenge. Jesus, after he died and arose from the grave, appeared to his disciples, amazingly, in a locked room. And this is what he said to them. And these words mean something as you consider this film. Peace be with you. As the Father sent me, so I'm sending you. How far did the Father send Jesus Christ? What barriers, what huge cultural differences did God himself in the person of his son, Jesus Christ, cross to win our redemption? Far greater than the barriers that you saw, those cultural distances there. How much did he pay? Far more than the people paid who you saw this morning. And that is the challenge to us, because that is the... Those are some of the final words that Jesus left with us. As the Father, in the way that the Father sent me, I'm sending you. However far it is, and whatever it might cost. We sang a song about that this morning, about the giving of our lives. Here's some people who had done it. And by the way, don't feel sorry for them. If you had offered them, once God's call is upon you and you know what it is, there is a joy that cannot be resisted. And if someone would have offered Don Richardson the presidency of the United States or to be the King of England, he would have said to them, I'm sorry, I've got a greater calling in Irinjaya. I can guarantee that. The joy of the Lord will be ours. So I think in a perhaps a minor way, but perhaps no less frightening, the challenge to you and to me this morning is, in the coming weeks as we step into this Christmas season, we will be in situations, whether it's at work or with family, that are frighteningly antagonistic to the truth we know about God. Be prepared to say that word. Be prepared to tell what the real meaning of Christmas is. With joy, the Lord will bring amazing blessing, as he brought amazing blessing.